From WIPR, I'm Sheila Cast. We're on the record. Thousands of children and adults have crossed the southern U.S. border. For some, violence in their home countries pushed them to this risky journey. While the practice of separating families at the border has ended, about 2,000 children have yet to be reunited with their parents. Emily Kephart from the legal advocacy group Kids in Need of Defense tells us about a case of a 6-year-old girl who for weeks has been held far from her father.
First and foremost, they are children. I think that's a big gap in the immigration system that considers them migrants first and children second.
Then UMBC political science professor Jeffrey Davis describes treaties and international laws that govern how refugees are treated and promise them due process. It's on the record after the news.
You're listening to On the Record, the podcast, a service of your public radio, 88.1 WYPR. Find more podcasts online at WYPR.org. And tell us what you think. Send an email to ontherecord@WYPR.org.
Good morning, I'm Sheila Cast. We're On the Record. Since early May, more than 2,300 children have been separated from their families after crossing the U.S.-Mexico border. About 500 children have since been reunited with their families, but thousands more, including children who crossed alone, remain in U.S. custody. Last month, President Trump ended the practice of family separation, but left many questions open. When will the rest of the children be back with their loved ones? What happens if their parents already have been deported? What legal protections are those fleeing violence in their home countries entitled to? Later, we'll talk with the UMBC political science professor about the international laws that govern treatment of asylees. First, Emily Kephart is senior coordinator of reintegration programs at Kids in Need of Defense. KIND provides free legal assistance to unaccompanied children. Kephart works at KIND's Baltimore field office, and she joins us now. Welcome to On the Record.
Good morning. Thank you.
Data collected by Syracuse University finds that the United States has initiated twice as many deportation proceedings against children this fiscal year compared to 2017. About two-thirds of children appear in court without an attorney, double the rate of last year. What difference does legal representation make for unaccompanied children?
In our cases, we have absolutely seen that when children appear in immigration court accompanied by an attorney who can represent them and their interests and their desires, they have a 95% likelihood of achieving some outcome, some promising outcome to their cases. Immigration law is a vast and complicated section of law, and to expect children to be able to represent themselves adequately in front of a judge is neither fair to the child nor the judge. So having an attorney in an immigration court hearing makes all the difference.
Let me probe that a bit. How are children, I mean, as young as toddlers, expected to make their case at a deportation hearing?
I don't think that anybody has a real expectation that they could. It's really complicated for the judge and obviously for a child. They can't.
What does the person or the person representing the person seeking asylum have to make clear to the judge to try to win the case?
A child seeking asylum needs to be able to articulate what they fear or what they have experienced in their home country, why they can't be protected in their own country, why their government can't protect them, and how, if they go back, their life or the lives of their family members will be at risk again. And many times, as you can imagine, a child as young as 3 is probably not even aware that their life is in danger if they're truly fleeing a risk and seeking asylum. So for them to be expected to articulate those fears in very precise ways, according to asylum law, is really impossible.
Defenders of the system argue that the judges in these deportation hearings help the kids get through the law. What's been your experience?
I mean, it's really depends on the individual judges. Individual judges run their courtrooms very differently, and they have the discretion of how to do that. I have seen many judges give continuances for a time so that a child will not have to try to stumble through, so that nobody will have to stumble through a court proceeding with an unrepresented three-year-old. As you can imagine, judges don't want to try to make a decision on that case with no adult there speaking for the child.
That's Emily Kephart, Senior Coordinator of Reintegration Programs at Kids in Need of Defense, KIND, which offers pro bono representation to unaccompanied immigrant and refugee children in legal proceedings like deportation. You work to locate a six-year-old girl who had been separated from her father. Describe that process.
I received an email from a nonprofit organization that we work with in Guatemala requesting assistance. A family had come to them explaining that this father and his daughter had migrated some months ago and that they had been separated upon entering the U.S. and that they hadn't heard anything from the six-year-old daughter and that they had heard very minimal information from the father and that the father hadn't heard anything from the daughter. So the father was put into ICE custody. And then the daughter was put into custody in a shelter with the Office of Refugee Resettlement. And so at the time that I got that email, 6 weeks had passed since anybody had heard anything from the little girl. I took the information that our partners in Guatemala gave us from the family with contact information, names, dates of birth of both the child and her parents. And I called the helpline that the Office of Refugee Resettlement has set up in part for these situations. I was able to give that information to the operator who answered the helpline. She located a child with a similar name and similar date of birth, but not the exact child that I was talking about, which was illustrative of some of the difficulties. If the person who's registering you into that database misspells your name, it could be the difference between somebody locating you and somebody not locating you.
And is that what turned out to happen in this case?
Yes, in this case, it turned out that it was the same child that she found in the database, just had a misspelling and a typographical error on her birth date.
And so you were able to find out where that six-year-old girl was being held.
Yes. Eventually, I called a shelter, a case manager that I have worked with previously on other cases, to say, I have this family looking for their daughter. I think she may be in one of your facilities. And I gave her the information, and she was very surprised and very relieved that child was on the caseload of her coworker. And so I had located her, and that case manager transferred me to the person who was responsible for this child. And it still took some weeks for the child to be able to speak with her family in Guatemala. And actually, I'm still working. The case manager and I are still working on trying to get the girl a phone call with her father in ICE detention. So she's been here at this point almost 8 weeks and has still not had any communication with the person from whom she was separated, in this case, her dad.
And this is all complicated, right? Because she not only doesn't speak English, she doesn't speak Spanish.
She speaks, from what we understand, she speaks primarily an indigenous language. She may speak some Spanish, but her family speaks an indigenous Mayan language.
So we don't know whether she's had a conversation with anybody she feels she can trust.
Correct. Absolutely.
So in this case, you tracked her down. What else can KIND do? It tears at the heart.
Absolutely. Some of our offices, definitely our legal services office in New York and Seattle, are both working to provide detained legal services to detained children. So they are going and doing legal screenings and offering their representation to these children who are in shelters or foster care systems in New York and Seattle. Our organization has also sent a team of attorneys to the border to work with parents who are detained after having been separated to try to make sure that they are able to articulate their cases, that they get access to due process, and that they can be reunified with their children if possible.
In this case, the father is still in custody.
Yes.
In the U.S.
Yes.
If a child's parents have been deported, how can they be reunited?
That is a very big question, and we don't know the answer exactly. Over the last year, I have worked with many cases of children who were separated from their family member. And the family member was quickly deported, and the child remains in custody in the Office of Refugee Resettlement for several months. It is a lengthy process. The child has to go through their immigration court hearing and decide that they want to return home. And that process takes a while to get through the court hearing and then to have travel arrangements made. And then somebody, of course, has to coordinate in the home country, communication with the parents and letting them know when the child will be arriving and where to go get them.
Can children who were separated from their families at the border be placed with other relatives in the U.S.?
They can be. There is a screening process for people who wish to sponsor a child and get them out of the Office of Refugee Resettlement's custody. That screening process is difficult and lengthy. It used to be that the Office of Refugee Resettlement was entirely responsible for the screening, and now they have turned over some of the fingerprinting and the criminal background checking to ICE, to immigration authorities. So now people who may be undocumented are much more reluctant to come forward.
We mentioned the conditions that families might be fleeing, but didn't really go into them. What conditions are these families escaping?
Many, many of these families are escaping levels of violence that are unimaginable for most of us who live here, even those of us who live in Baltimore. It's levels of violence, levels of violence against children, violence against women, and the impunity of the places where these people come from, the fact that you can't necessarily make a police report and expect protection or justice for the crimes that are being committed in your neighborhood, the fact that if you go to the police, you may be seen then as a target for having told anybody anything. People are cut off from access to justice, access to protection, even if they haven't themselves been victimized. They live in areas that are controlled by gangs. There's certainly structural oppression and things like that also.
What do you want people to know about the children KIND represents?
That they're children. First and foremost, they are children. I think that's a big gap in the immigration system that considers them migrants first and children second. And they're children and they're people that we as adults and as a society have a mandate to protect, no matter where they come from or who they are. And I think that keeping in mind their basic needs, their basic rights to shelter, to the feeling of safety and family is paramount. And the fact that they need people who are standing up for both their interests and their safety.
Emily, thank you.
Thanks. Thank you.
Emily Kephart is Senior Coordinator of Reintegration Programs at the nonprofit Kids in Need of Defense, KIND. She's based in Baltimore, one of KIND's 13 field offices around the U.S. This is On the Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cass. Quick break. When we come back, a professor of human rights tells us what international laws offer protection to refugees and asylees. Stay tuned.
This is the On the Record podcast, a service of Your Public Radio, member-supported 88.1 WYPR. You can support this podcast and everything you hear from WYPR. Become a member. Come to WYPR.org and click the donate link.
Welcome back to On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking today about the international law that protects those seeking asylum in the United States. In the last 2 months, 2,300 children have been separated from their parents at the border. The Washington Post reports that a further 10,000 children are in the custody of the Department of Health and Human Services. These children arrived unaccompanied. On June 20th, President Trump signed an executive order to end family separation.
So we're keeping families together, and this will solve that problem. At the same time, we are keeping a very powerful border, and it continues to be a zero tolerance. We have zero tolerance for people that enter our country illegally.
Moving forward, families will be held in custody together. NPR reports that tent encampments for this purpose will be constructed at two military bases in Texas. Jeffrey Davis is a professor in the Political Science Department at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. He's the author of two books on human rights, Seeking Human Rights Justice in Latin America and Justice Across Borders, The Struggle for Human Rights in U.S. Courts. He's also written a piece for the website The Conversation titled U.S. Zero Tolerance Immigration Policy Still Violating Fundamental Human Rights Laws. Professor Davis, welcome to On the Record.
Thank you.
What does President Trump mean by zero tolerance?
It's the administration's policy of punishing people who cross into the United States as criminals, whether they have committed any crime or not. So someone comes seeking asylum from Guatemala, that person is going to be treated as a criminal and locked up and prosecuted for entering the country, in the administration's opinion, unlawfully.
One of President Trump's tweets appears to call for immediate deportation. He tweeted, quote, "We cannot allow all of these people to invade our country. When someone comes in, we must immediately, with no judges or court cases, bring them back from where they came," close quote. Do people who are not citizens have a right to due process?
Of course they do. Anyone in the United States has constitutional rights. As soon as they're inside the United States borders, the Constitution kicks in and they're protected by the Due Process Clause in the Fifth Amendment and the 14th Amendment also.
What international treaties govern the treatment of asylum seekers?
So there are at least two that protect individuals crossing the border. The first is the Refugee Convention, which the United States made part of its own law by ratifying the Refugee Convention Protocol.
And that was when?
That was in 1968. Mm. The protocol was passed in 1968. We ratified it sometime later.
And what does it hold?
So the protocol basically made the Refugee Convention extend past the problems that existed after World War II. The Refugee Convention was passed after World War II in order to protect the hundreds of thousands of refugees that existed as a result of the war and as a result of the Holocaust. And that convention is very important because what it recognized was we as a global community have a responsibility for refugees existing, for the refugee problem. All of us, every nation, has some part in causing these crises to exist. It also recognizes that because of that, we have a responsibility to protect these refugees, and that the protections will only work if all nations cooperate to do so. And that system is breaking down now, partially because the United States isn't carrying its own weight. If you look at the refugees in the world right now, most of them, 90% of them, are housed in countries that are directly next to where the crisis is occurring. And those countries are poor, they're developing, and they're ill-equipped to handle this problem on their own.
What does that convention say about seeking asylum?
So it recognizes that you have a fundamental human right to seek asylum. And so if you are in danger, if you're being persecuted in your home country, you have a human right, a legal right, to seek asylum in another country. And that treaty prohibits countries like the United States from punishing people who ask for asylum, even if they crossed into that country illegally.
I interrupted you. You said there were at least two treaties.
So the other one is the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. And in the global community, that's known as the International Bill of Rights. And so it was passed and ratified by the United States, and it basically includes the human rights we think of as existing in our Constitution and in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And so this prohibits things like locking someone up without due process. It prohibits dividing families. It prohibits not giving a person a right to challenge their detention in a court of law.
Can someone apply for asylum without crossing the border?
No, you have to be, well, there are systems that the United Nations High Commission for Refugees has put in place for internally displaced people, people who have run away from persecution but are still in the country. And if they're under the protection of the United Nations High Commission for Refugees, some systems exist for them to appeal for asylum and resettlement, even though they're still in country. But most of the time, refugees have escaped their country and in another country, and that's when they ask for asylum. In fact, the provision of the treaty that talks about asylum states that when you are not in your home country, when you've escaped your home country.
So the logic of what you're telling us is that if these international obligations the U.S. has taken on require that people be able to seek asylum, it is legal for them to come into, to cross our border to seek that asylum.
They are protected by these treaties, so they can't be punished for crossing illegally. Of course, every country has the right to set up legal procedures for how you enter that country, right? And the United States is well within its authority to say, if you want to come to the United States, you have to go through a border crossing where there's border officials there to check your documents. They can do that. And if you don't follow those instructions, you have violated U.S. procedures. However, the Refugee Convention protects people seeking asylum from being punished for violating those provisions if they are seeking asylum.
That's UMBC political science professor Jeffrey Davis here on The Record on WYPR. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about the treatment of families seeking asylum at the border. The New York Times reports that in the last 2 months, Border Patrol referred more than 2,000 adults traveling with children to the Justice Department for prosecution. And that leaves me a bit confused. If they're prosecuted and found guilty, then what? Because the U.S. will also seek to deport them, right? So
right.
Why prosecute?
So the point of prosecuting is really to create a disincentive for people trying to come here. So because what the United States is doing for the most part is they are convicting them and then sentencing them to time served, the time they've already spent in detention, and then deporting them. And this raises another crucial part of the Refugee Convention, a part called the non-refoulement principle, which prohibits any country from sending someone back to a country where they're going to be, where their freedom or their well-being is in danger because of five certain categories: their religion, their membership in a social group, their political opinion, things like that. So even if they came unlawfully, and even if the moment they came they weren't entitled to asylum, if they can prove that if they're sent back to Honduras or Guatemala or El Salvador, that they're going to be in danger because of these five categories, we cannot send them back.
Another issue, of course, is the length of time for which adults and children are detained. How long can people be held?
That's another human rights violation that's occurring in this current environment and also during the Obama administration, is that we're detaining people for extended periods without any right of due process, without any right to challenge their detention, without any right to bail. The Supreme Court recently decided a case where basically they decided not to address those constitutional issues and instead sent the case back to a lower court. And in that case, it was a class action, so there were numerous petitioners, plaintiffs. Some had been detained as long as 4 years. Asylum seekers had been detained as long as 2 years in that case without any right to a bail hearing.
And the Supreme Court
did not
rule
decide
on
constitutionality.
That...
Correct, yeah.
U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions recently said that domestic violence and gang violence would no longer be considered the basis for asylum claims. Does that comport with international guidelines?
No, it doesn't. There are cases from other countries and guidance from the United Nations High Commission for Refugees that both conditions can meet the requirements of asylum. And the way that works is if the home country, for example, Guatemala, isn't protecting women from domestic violence, that's the persecution that gives that person the right to seek asylum in the United States. If the country, let's say El Salvador, isn't protecting children from gang violence, that's the persecution that gives those children the right to asylum in the United States.
And so is the Attorney General's ruling something that can be challenged then in U.S. courts?
It can be challenged in U.S. courts. What you would need is someone seeking asylum on the basis of those grounds to be represented by an advocacy group to challenge those decisions in court if they are denied asylum.
The U.N. estimates there are 25 million refugees and 3 million asylum seekers worldwide. What impact do the United States' actions toward families at the U.S.-Mexico border make on its international standing?
The system of asylum and refugee protection only works if everyone is pulling their fair share. If you look at the United Nations High Commission for Refugee numbers, the countries that are taking most refugees are often the smallest countries, like Lebanon, for example, or developing countries with weaker economies. And as a result, the system is untenable. You know, you have countries like Denmark with a strong economy but a very small population doing way more than its fair share in taking refugees and asylum seekers. And so eventually, countries are much more reluctant to cooperate with the United States in solving global problems, like refugee problems, like climate change, if we're not pulling our fair share.
I appreciate your walking us through it. Thank you.
No, thanks for having me. Yeah.
Professor Jeffrey Davis teaches political science and international law at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. At the On the Record page at WIPR.org, we'll link to his piece published on The Conversation, U.S. Zero Tolerance Immigration Policy Still Violating Fundamental Human Rights Laws. This is On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow.
Thanks for listening to this segment of On the Record with Sheila Cast. You can catch the show on the radio Monday through Friday, 9:30 to 10 a.m. on 88.1 WYPR, your NPR news station. And you can support On the Record and all the other public radio programs that WYPR brings to you. Just click the donate link at the top of WYPR.org. And thanks.